The subject I'm going to talk about today is the question of whether the human being is naturally religious. And, you know, my own formation background is more in academic theology, but I will make some appeals to philosophical positions or talk about philosophical positions. This talk is somewhat popular in the sense that I'm giving an introduction. So if you're an academic philosopher, you may find that the positions are not articulated as technically as they could be. It's true, this is a sort of postcard overview. But I do want to expose different positions and try to think about options intellectually, and then situate Aquinas's view, which I'm sympathetic to for reasons I'll explain, situate his view relative to other views. So let me start, as the handout might suggest. You don't need to look at the handout, but it would give you a clue here what's going on. I want to start by talking about two contrasting positions that also differ from that of Aquinas at the beginning. And one of them is a very important, historically important, theological position, which is that religion is a virtue in the human person that is not primarily natural, but rather, as the medieval theologians would say, supernatural. It's an effect or fruit of grace and charity. And so the human being is, in a certain sense, not naturally religious. That may seem like a strange place to start, but as you'll see, I hope, it actually is a strangely modern position. And then the positions I want to look at in counter-reaction, which in a way mirror that position as an opposite, are a series of positions that argue in different and nuanced ways that religion is fundamentally unnatural, that in a certain sense the human being is naturally secular, or that religion represents a kind of alienation of the human mind from its own kind of true domain, and it's not, religious stances towards human existence are sort of ill-conceived. So after I've laid out those two kinds of positions, I want to talk about how Aquinas is different and distinct from both, but also has something in common with each. So let's start our story with Bonaventure, who is an important medieval, brilliant thinker, a Franciscan of the 13th century, who knew Aquinas personally and was slightly older than him, but lived longer than him, and who wrote theology just a little before him in most respects. So a person who Aquinas often responds to and reacts against in many cases. Bonaventure asks in the famous Sentences commentary, which is a great medieval commentary everyone wrote when they wanted to be a theologian, whether the virtue of religion is a supernatural virtue. The word super here doesn't mean something like superhero. It's from the Greek, you know, above nature, meaning a derivative from God's grace. And basically Bonaventure argues for what is effectively a safe position at the beginning of the 13th century, which is that religion is the fruit of the infused grace of charity. Religion is a supernatural virtue derived from the love of God poured into our hearts by the Holy Spirit. Now that sounds like a very pious and profoundly Christian idea. To be religious is to be a being of charity. Charity is a grace. It's a grace given into the will, primarily, into the heart, the spiritual will, which allows the human person to direct themselves to the love of God and neighbor in accord with God's own love of God's self and of our neighbors. In other words, we can be conformed to God's love spiritually or mystically by grace, and in that sense become religious people. Now, this position, actually Aquinas will disagree with, and I will too. even though it sounds like it's the obvious kind of Christian theological position to take, let me talk a bit about its roots. It originates from the grounding base text of thinking about religion in the medieval tradition, which is Augustine's famous book, City of God, Book 10, Chapter 6. Bonaventure sees himself as an Augustinian. He's defending the position of Augustine. So what's Augustine doing? Well, Augustine, as you may well know, in the book The City of God, is writing in his late part of his life, after the collapse, in a certain sense, of the Roman imperial kingdom in the face of the northern invasions, wherein the Greco-Roman religionists, or the Roman religionists, let's call them pagan religionists, have argued that it's a curse that Rome has been destroyed in part because of the betrayals of the Roman gods by the Christians. Right? So it's a divine punishment of the gods. And so Augustine is writing back a defense of Christianity in the wake of this critique and is himself offering a critique of pagan religion. And basically, Augustine argues famously that there are two cities in this world. There's the city of man and the city of God. And the city of man is the city where the primacy of self-love reigns, egoistic, self-centered love. And that is an effect of the fallen state, of original sin, present in all human beings, from our first parents who rejected the grace of God. And then there's the city of God, which is the city in which the human heart is healed and elevated by grace, the city of charity, the city of love. And that is the city of the true religion. And that's being instantiated in this world by the church. So effectively, what he wants to argue is Greco-Roman religion is effectively a kind of pagan religion built on self-interest, the self-interest of the emperor, the self-interest of human civilization of a group of people who want to conquer other people. You could call it an early critique of Roman colonialism, an anti-colonial, critique of Roman imperialism, and that religion is also a kind of construct of the human self to try to barter with the gods and get what you want. So in other words, he wants to argue in a way the worm eating at the heart of the rotten apple of pagan religion is self-interested love. And against this, you get the disinterested higher love of God and neighbor that comes about as a result of grace. And Christianity alone is the true religion, fruit of grace. Now, look, that's obviously in some ways, if you just take the critique of paganism, a rather modern idea, which is a lot of religious behavior in the world is effectively needs to be interpreted psychologically as self-interested, potentially pathological, often allied with all kinds of nebulous and strange political ideas, and is in need of strong cultural critique. Okay, so the Augustinian legacy is the idea that religion, as you find it in human civilization, is often very problematic. So that's not what we might think. You might think you go into Christian theology and you find this robust defense of human religion. Actually, it starts in conflict, and it's actually rather critical. It's not an accident that in the Western European world you would have the strongest criticisms of religion emerge in the Enlightenment, because there are some antecedents to this in the patristic era. It's not just Augustine, but especially Augustine, in the critique of human religion as embodied in the Greco-Roman recent past. Okay. Now, Bonaventure, is more serene. Christianity is now the normative religion, but effectively takes on this idea that normative religious behavior depends upon grace and is itself formally a fruit of grace, and that outside the world of grace, outside the world of charity, outside the Christian religion, and you're thinking concretely here with these guys, the Catholic Mass, the sacrifice of the Mass, wherein the people of God are led to worship God in a real transcendent, clarity. Outside of that, the world is night, and there's going to be a lot of confusion in religion, and then they have a lot of things in these treatises in the Middle Ages on superstition, bad religion, ways things go wrong. Let me just stop there with that first view. I mean, you have modern proponents of this view, even more extreme in some ways, like Karl Barth in the 20th century, who argues that all human religion is effectively a false construct of the human self that needs to be cleared away to make room for Christian revelation. But my point is that the earliest Western severe critiques of human religiosity come from the theologians. And they're not crazy. I mean, there's all kinds of strange... it's interesting, if you read Robert Bella, he was one of the greatest sociologists of religion of our era, and he died maybe 5 years ago, but Robert Bella, who was at Berkeley, wrote a rather interesting last work called Religion and Human Evolution. And he details there the widespread prevalency of human sacrifice in human religion in ancient China, in the ancient Near Middle East, and he studies it at length in Hawaii, the religion that Captain Cook discovered in the 18th century, and the prevalency of human sacrifice as a component of human religiosity. And so what you find is things like, that's just an example, but you find the prevalency of human sacrifice in human religion. It should give pause for thought, Okay. So let me move to the idea then that religion is unnatural, and I want to turn here to, obviously I'm going fast, I'm just giving some general overview, bullet points, ideas. I want to turn to the modern, what I'll call the masters of suspicion. It's obviously not my term, that's a common term, but the masters of suspicion who inseminate the intellectual idea in modernity that religion is a kind of social vice. It's not only unnatural, it not only dehumanizes the human mind and will, delimits our freedom or makes us unclear about our ethical obligations, but it in some way creates widespread social delusion and is a hindrance to social progress. So let me first just talk about the softer view of this. The softer view of this, which is, I think, the most prevalent in certainly the North American context to this day, I think it's strongly felt in the Anglo-Saxon world. It's certainly strongly felt in Germany. And this is the sort of a moderate settlement position, I would call it, of Immanuel Kant. Kant lives from 1724 to 1804. So we're talking about, you know, an 18th century view. Think the era of the French Revolution. Okay. Immanuel Kant wants to react against the strident, kind of more aggressive, atheistic position of Hume, who has deeply influenced him. I don't mean to insult anyone in Edinburgh, and of course I recognize Hume as a important thinker, but, you know, it does seem like, however coy about he is about it, he's a pretty assiduous atheist. And Kant wants to, as it were, thwart the gravity and the radicality of his position as that of Spinoza, who I take to be an atheist, and I think Kant thinks so too. On the other hand, he wants to thwart people like Leibniz, who are trying to give philosophical defenses of strong traditional doctrine of Christianity, like classical ideas about grace and revelation and the incarnation. So Leibniz is going too far, using Enlightenment philosophy to defend Christianity in too, or orthodoxy in too aggressive a way. Hume is going too far to try to just, you know, desolate the possibility intellectually of modern Christianity. So in 1783, Kant writes a sketch book. It's a shorter book, but a fascinating one, Prolegomena to Any Future Metaphysics. And he sketches out the idea there that he'll use later in the Critique of Pure Reason in 1790, that knowledge of God by way of philosophical demonstration in this life is not possible. There are no philosophically demonstrable, there are no compelling arguments for the existence of God. He also is going to try to block out the idea in the Critique of Pure Reason that there are compelling arguments against belief in the existence of God. Right? So he wants to neutralize the epistemological warrants of both atheism and strong confidence in theism. You might say he is a theoretically certain agnostic. We can be certain that we can neither prove nor disprove the existence of God. Right? So it's kind of the safe place of agnosticism. But he does think the idea of God functions necessarily as a, as he calls it, an illusion of transcendental reason, meaning we need to have an idea of God to make sense and organize our thinking about reality. You have to think about some absolute principle that's first, in light of which everything else is understood, a kind of organizing first principle that helps you construct the notion of a causal world, a world caused in an intricate but unified way under one dominion or under one source. So you think about the world as if God has created it or somehow sustaining it or causing it to be, so you can think about the world in a unified way. But you actually have no evidence of that, nor can you attain evidence of that. It's a kind of, you might say, useful heuristic idea, a pedagogical idea of transcendental reason to allow you to organize the experience of the senses around a unified body of knowledge. Or to unify your body of knowledge around the, constituent way to make sense of the what appears in the field of the senses. And so, as I've noted then, he goes on to argue in that work and the Critique of Pure Reason that we can attain no theoretical knowledge of God as such. Now, he gets more aggressive, the program comes out in all of its force in 1793 in his book Religion Within the Boundaries of Mere Reason, which I think is the most important, single most important book written in the modern era if you want to understand the charter of secularism. I mean, if you're just trying to understand where political secularism comes from, you need to read Spinoza's Theological and Political Authorities, which is the sort of document, but then if you want to, it's like the grandfather document, but if you want to read the father document, if you don't mind the patriarchal imagery, just for, you know, I mean, we could call it the grand maternal and the maternal if you want, but anyway, the point is you get the idea. If you want to read the sort of source document, Religion Within the Boundaries of Mere Reason is the sketchbook of modern secular government. And one interesting thing he argues, fascinating, lots of fascinating ideas there. One argument I want to just flag is he goes through the Ten Commandments and talks about what perennial value they should have in the modern world. He says basically the first table, the first three commandments that require you morally to be related to God by love, the pursuit of knowledge and love of God, recognition of God in the public square through the keeping of the Sabbath and so forth, this can be eradicated. It's time for this to go. It's the second table of the seven commandments that commend us to responsibility toward our neighbor, that are the heart of Christianity. Yet once you demythologize it, once you get rid of the revelation, once you get rid of the kind of moral obligations unto God, true religion, he says, and I'm paraphrasing him, but I think it's right to paraphrase him like this bluntly, true religion is entirely composed in the obligations to love and to treat your fellow neighbor with justice according to the norms in a politically ethical way. Okay, so you might say it this way. Being a good member of the political liberal state is the way you keep the commandments in the modern world after the Enlightenment has done away with some of the falderal of Christian revelation. And he also says that belief in grace of the kind Bonaventure postulates, like charity poured into the heart to conform you to the love of God, is incompatible with human responsibility. If you want to be a grown-up, moral person, you cannot depend on grace or revelation because that infantilizes you, and it also teaches you that you're a pure passive puppet in the face of God's activity who is not obliged to perform acts of responsibility actively. But you are rationally compelled to perform acts of responsibility actively. Therefore, the whole notion of grace acting on you passively as a principle of human responsibility and ethics is bunk, and we have to get rid of it. Okay, so he's purposefully very Pelagian, if you want to characterize him theologically. And so, you know, that's a very strong set of moves. And you can see how it makes a certain view of religion, of a Christian kind, dependent on a theory of grace or divine revelation, it problematizes it. And in his last work, Perpetual Peace, a Philosophical Sketch from 1795, basically Kant writes a charter of the modern liberal state. If you want to understand the modern EU or the sort of modern secular vision of the horizon of human history as basically a kind of immanentistic secular project of creating an ethical world in this life only and working for that future relentlessly, it's all chartered by this great last treatise of Kant, where he calls for the kind of international democratic secular community with open borders, market economies, exchanges, constitutional prerogatives of modern democracy, free press, secular government. Okay, so, I mean, there's very little that's going on he didn't think up in a certain sense. I mean, he wasn't alone, but he is really the most central figure. That means that transcendence after Kant is not transcendence, you know, if I can put it visually, upward into the eternal life of God. Transcendence is transcendence forward into the political horizon of the future of history. You know, we go into the future of history through political progress, secular political progress, as the way of achieving transcendence. Okay, so we can move now to Feuerbach, who's a more aggressive version, in his book Essence of Christianity from 1841. Now, of course, we're fast-forwarding here 50 years. And Feuerbach, in a way, builds on Kant. You had that idea of you had that notion of God as an idea of regulatory reason, a heuristic illusion of transcendental reason used to organize thought. But it's still positive in Kant. You need an idea of God to kind of think as if the world was a coherent whole and you can make sense of it causally. But in Feuerbach, you get the move that God is effectively a projection of man's idealized moral nature. God is a projection of man's idealized moral nature. In other words, God is the idea of the most perfect human ethical behavior. If we want to try to think about how to instantiate the most perfect humanistic, idealistic acts of justice, goodness, and so forth, we project that onto an idea, we project that onto a being we call God that has no real instantiation in the reality around us. So religion is, in some ways, naturally good as a system of symbols about anthropological or human moral behavior, but it needs to be demythologized. Once we remove the mythology around the idea of a god or a religious kind of set of practices, we see there's an anthropological essence of religion, that the essence is moral and that by getting, we can effectively, we don't need to reject everything that's come to us through the vehicles of traditional religion, but we do need to go through it now critically and feel and identify what the effectively the ethical and anthropological imperatives of religion are, and just remove those and leave the dross of dogma, symbol, sacred worship, and liturgy behind, as well as the big metaphysical claims about God and the soul. So, I mean, you know, it's a pretty strong atheistic reductio. And we should finish, we can finish with our dear friends, which we'll speak about only very briefly, Freud, Nietzsche, and Marx, who are really the, when you talk about the masters of suspicion, they're the main guys. Because think about it, if God doesn't exist, okay, great, we've disproven the existence of God, we've given good philosophical arguments against it, okay, super. But why are all these people still religious? I mean, what are they, if it's so unnatural and if it's not rational, what are they doing being religious? They must have some motivation. We need to explain their motivations. We need to disillusion them or understand what the illusion is that has led them to this alienation from their own best human nature. Okay, so it's a little condescending, but, you know, it is, it's basically an atheist's, I think it's essential to atheism ultimately to try to explain why you get the pathology of religion that emerges or why it continues. So one of the great works, a beautiful work actually, just incredible work of writing and thinking, short book, Civilization is Discontents from Freud, written in 1929, 10 years before Freud dies, is his attempt to explain religion as a form of human psychological alienation from reality. And the source of this reality is effectively the fact that we have to confront the subconsciously, we confront the fact that we live in a world that is impersonal, in which we are doomed to death in subjection to a physical cosmos without any overarching providence, meaning, or destiny. Now, because we are personal, or we live by, you know, personal forms of communication of knowledge and love with other people, we would like to think the universe has a paternal figure protecting us, that there's a providence, that there's a personal destiny, that there's immortality. But these are psychological projections, because we are incapable of living psychologically with the sober realization of our own mortality in the face of what is effectively a impersonal and unprotecting universe, in which the truth metaphysically is that of, you might say, material naturalism. There's just a natural material world, no souls, no angels, no God, no personal destiny beyond death. And so accepting death in all its cold reality, you might say, and the human condition in its non-religious situation, it's sobering. And so, you know, we often, as a result, are alienated from that into a psychological world of religious projection. And so atheism has a positive role to play in allowing us to achieve psychological maturity, explaining to us the true causes of religion and why it's a social pathology, a kind of denial of reality. But the grown-ups acknowledge reality. The psychological grown-ups acknowledge reality. Nietzsche is a wonderfully complicated and insightful psychologist in his own way, who Freud said was the greatest modern psychologist. And I mean, Nietzsche's positions are complicated. I want to seem over simple, but I mean, to summarize one aspect, the idea of the will to power. If you want to understand Nietzsche's critique of Christianity in a seminal way, go to his critique of Judaism. The Jews are the cause of all the real problems in Western religious society. That is the strong claim he makes. Because the Old Testament is a book written by an oppressed people in the ancient world, constructed by the priests of ancient Israel and Hebraic society after they were socially disenfranchised by the Babylonian Empire, downtrodden, with their monarchy destroyed and their holy places obliterated and their country conquered. And they composed the Old Testament effectively, primarily, as a way to subjugate the strong to a religion that favors the weak. What they discovered in it, you could say, in their political situation of liminal political situation of weakness, was the theology of God's mercy for the weak, the primacy of the weak, the primacy of the lowly, the primacy of the disenfranchised. And they created a religion that favors the weak over the strong by appealing to a god who would punish the noble, the excellent, and the powerful. And so they created a religion of that would be, could be used as a social mechanism to disenfranchise the strong and subject them to the weak through what he calls the frustrated will to power of this conquered people. Basically, they want the power. They don't have the power. They're disenfranchised. But they create a sacerdotal religion to control the powerful by subjecting them to the religion that gives primacy to the weak and the disenfranchised. And then Jesus then walks in and intensifies and perfects this through the evangelical precepts. And so Jesus is, in a way, the best Jew and the most dangerous, because he gives you the radical religion of the primacy of the weak and of mercy. And what we need is to return to the Greek ideal of nobility, beauty, power, and strength, and artistic freedom. And I'm not going to get into more about it, but the point is, Nietzsche thinks we've been subject to a deep cultural alienation from the will to art and the will to power, which is a will to nobleness and greatness, which we inherited from the Hellenistic tradition and the Roman tradition, but which we subjugated to the biblical Hebraic tradition, and which we need to liberate ourselves from. Okay, Marx is, I think, also close to Freud. Basically, Marx makes a lot of sense if you just think that religion is, when he says religion is an opiate of the masses, what he means is there are social classes of persons, or there are social categories of persons, who are disenfranchised in permanent ways, sociologically, repetitively, under classes. I mean, he thinks in terms of society, social classes, like, you know, the worker class. But you could also talk about certain, you know, groups that racially have been subordinate in certain racist societies, or where there have been racial inequalities. Or you could talk about the feminization of poverty. Okay, so today you use those kinds of class and gender and categories and race categories to think about structures of people who've been disenfranchised. And one of the ways that people who have been disenfranchised over long periods of time react is they use the idea of a justice delayed until after death to weather the storms of this life, right? So we experience a lot of political oppression or economic disenfranchisement in this life. We don't conduct the revolution. We don't change this world. We say, well, God will eventually vindicate us in the life to come. And in that case, we take that as an opiate to numb ourselves to the obligation and the prerogative to actually make social change happen in this life. And so we become alienated from participation in our own society because we feel disenfranchised, and so we use religion to placate ourselves against the backdrop of a horizon we hope exists after this life. But in that sense, we're not really taking on the prerogatives of social revolution in this world as we ought to. Of course, this idea, like Nietzsche's, in different ways in National Socialism, which tried to eradicate Hebraic influence on modern European society, and in Marxism, there were huge political attempts to initiate change in society based on these ideas, and I'm not going to sit here and detail the political effects of all that. I'm just going to, you know, note that there are, you know, it's not like Marx's ideas, you know, just been thought about but never tried. I mean, there was a real attempt to eradicate religion in Eastern Europe and Central Europe in accord with his views, and that is just something to consider when you think about what was done and how well that worked or didn't work. Okay, now those are all admittedly very almost incautiously general sketches, but what I want to do now is turn to Aquinas on the virtue of religion and set out a course that's neither Bonaventurian nor Kantian Freudian, and which is built up around Aquinas' account of the virtue of religion in the Summa Theologiae. You know, the Summa is cut into four parts, the so-called first part of the second part, the second part of the second part, and the third part. The second part was so big, it's on the human nature, it's so big he cuts it into two, the prima secundae in Latin and the secunda secundae. And in the secunda secundae, the second part of the second part, he treats all the virtues and vices. He gives a general sketch of a gazillion virtues and vices. And he has a whole section on the virtues of religion. Now, the first thing to say is, where does it appear? Because Aquinas looks at faith, hope, and charity, the three theological virtues, and then the four cardinal virtues, prudence, justice, courage, or fortitude, and temperance. Where does he put religion? He does not put it under charity. He puts it under justice. And he talks about it as a potential part of justice or a dimension of justice. In a certain sense, one of the greatest of the moral virtues. And articulates it primarily, first and foremost, as an interior disposition of justice. Why justice? Because justice renders unto another what is due to them. Now, that's a very broad analogical definition for Aquinas. Think about friendship. Because immediately if I say rendering another what's due, you think, oh, it's heavy, there's obligations. Well, think about like a friendship, right? So you're friends with somebody and, you know, you have, let's just say you have coffee with them once every 2 weeks. And you choose a coffee place one time and they choose a coffee place another time because, you know, you live at 20 minutes walk and sometimes you're closer to you, sometimes closer to them. Let's say for the sake of argument. But then you get the idea you're going to choose the coffee place always. Always. And then other little things like that. You know, you start making demands. Okay, you can undermine the friendship because you start treating the other person like they owe you a certain amount that actually isn't owed you, because you owe them something along the same lines, right? So if you lose justice, Aristotle says, in the friendship, you can corrupt the friendship, right? I mean, to take a simple example, most people, this is not a moralistic judgment, this is a sociological claim. Most people who are married prefer that their spouse not commit adultery. That's interesting, right? I mean, you could just say, well, that's just a old-fashioned view from Christian morality. Bourgeois, you know, okay. But it is interesting, most people consider it an injustice. And if it happens in a protracted way, it tends to undermine the friendship of the marriage. Okay, so my point is, justice is not the same thing as love. It's not as high as love, but it's a dimension of love. In friendship, you have justice. And Aquinas thinks friendship with God is a charity, is friendship with God by grace. But within charity, you also have a natural dimension of justice, of a kind of rendering to God what is due to him. And he looks at it in question 81 of the Secundus Secundae. Well, he continues to, like, through question 85 or 86, and he looks at vices against the virtue of religion. And what I want to just note are a couple of things. He starts with the interior life of justice, and then he moves up religion, and then he moves to the exterior. So, interestingly, he treats first what he calls devotion, which is not a good word for us to understand him, because when we think of devotions, we think of, like, that's people on Saturday mornings in churches, like lighting candles and saying special prayers and so forth. Yeah, I mean, I'm in favor of Catholic devotions, but that's not what he means. Devotio is a movement of the will by which you surrender in love to an ultimate good. Devotion is much more like what we would call adoration of God, or even ecstatic surrender. Ecstatic surrender unto what is truly good and a source of happiness. Right, so think about, I mean, if you use an all-too-human analogy, it's very Hollywood. Think about the man who falls in love with a woman, and he consents at some point to let himself become relative because he falls in love with her. Right, so she's a really wonderful person. He surrenders it in his heart to the goodness of her person. Well, Aquinas is thinking this can happen in a higher way with regards to God. You surrender to the goodness that God is through a movement of the will of devotion. And It corresponds in the intellect. It's like two pistons of an engine to prayer. Interestingly, Aquinas says prayer is an act of the intellect, not the will, primarily of the intellect. An intellectual praise, and prayer is intellectual. Now, he treats the will first. That's interesting because Aquinas thinks, he's very strong on saying, in all human action, the intellect leads the will. I cannot love what I don't first know. If I want to love God, I need to know God. So the intellect, if I want to know another person, if I want to love another person, I need to get to know them. Right? So the intellect gives you knowledge of the good, and then you can love the good. But the will follows the intellect. And he believes that here in this treatise. But he puts the will first because justice pertains to the right ordering of the will. And it is an act of justice to order ourselves rightly toward God. What do we owe God? What is rendered unto God willfully or freely? Well, we owe God everything. I mean, on Aquinas' view, we can actually know from natural reason that God is creating and sustaining and being the entire world at every given moment. All of that we are, everything that is in the order of existence, all of our being and act stems from God. He gives the act of being that is present in everything to everything that is. He gives us existence, not just in the past and leaving the world alone, right? But now he gives the world existence. He sustains it in being. And that means that we are currently entirely dependent upon God for our being, which God will not annihilate, but which is, because that is real and something very concrete, undergirding everything that is, lends us to rightly acknowledge the gift of existence as a gift given by God. And also because God governs all things that exist in some ultimate way, it is right to entrust ourselves to God's providence, that's to say, his wise and orderly governance of the world. In the face of, yes, even in the face of evil, we should affirm there's a providence, and we should entrust ourselves to it. Okay, so I'm not going to defend the rationality of belief in the existence of God, the rationality of belief in divine providence, or the belief that, you know, God can be believed in even in the face of the evils of this world. Those are all hard questions. Aquinas has arguments in those respects, but that's not what this talk is about. I'm presuming that those kinds of arguments could be made and even defended against the likes of Kant and Hume and so forth. And there's a lot of literature on that, and we can come back to that in Q&A. But if that's all true, then the will can incline itself to God in devotion, or you might say even in a kind of surrender toward the love of God and his goodness, under the movements of the intellect, because the intellect is still regent. And the intellect initiates this through prayer, which is the elevation of the mind to God through thinking. I mean, it's a very simple view of prayer, actually. I mean, what is prayer? Well, it starts in thinking about God, but also thinking unto God, or petitioning God, talking to God, seeking to contemplate God, seeking to know God. Now, Aquinas thinks both these things are natural to the human being. So, I mean, now to go back to Bonaventure briefly and to the modern masters. Against Bonaventure, Aquinas thinks that this core structure of the human person is natural and present in all human beings, including the ancient Romans, including the Hohaians, who were sacrificing living beings, you know, other human beings, including in all the non-Christian religious traditions that Christians may have critical questions about or critiques of. There is a core natural inclination in the human person to knowledge and love of God that is ineradicable, though it can be hindered. So, in other words, you could put it this way. Every human being potentially is religious in virtue of the kind of thing they are as a rational animal who has an intellect and who has free will. Just because we are the kind of animal that can know that God exists and can know something of God's providence, we are also the kind of animal that can raise our minds to God in prayer, and we are the kind of animal that can love God and even is meant to love God above all things, because God is truly, objectively speaking, the greatest of goods. And because we're not just a spirit, but are an intellectual free animal, but a bodily animal, psychologically embodied animal, we should be religious in a physical way as well as an intellectual way. Because whatever we love, we should love in our whole being, and to love God above all things is an act of the human person, not just of the mind and the will. So it's normal that we should be a liturgical animal, a religious animal, a corporately liturgical and religious animal, who embodies our religious acts socially through liturgy. So it's not strange that when we look out at the field of history, we find human beings often religious, liturgical, prayerful, devotional, sacrificial, and that we find human religion all through the vast field of human history, sociologically and anthropologically. So Aquinas argues that, you might say, against the hard Augustinian line that wants to make religion just a function of grace. He says it's out there. Now, with Bonaventure and Augustine, he says, absent the presence of grace, when human beings are left to themselves, they will often get their religious devotion and their religious prayer life and their theoretical belief life wrong. And he says they can worship the wrong thing, they can worship in the wrong way, they can sacrifice the wrong thing, they can use religion for self-interested reasons. They don't always have to. He thinks there can be instances of healthy religious behavior in human culture, and often, he actually says quite openly, there can be the work of Christian grace, or the grace of God present in non-Christian religions, moving people to love God above all things, even in domains outside visible Christian world. But there can also be things that are pathological. You know, so Aquinas gives you a very rich both-and view. It's natural, but it isn't working right without grace. When grace is there, it can be healed. Religious behavior can be healed and elevated. When grace is not there, you can get all kinds of religious pathological behavior, and a lot of the stuff that Marx, Freud, and Nietzsche are worried about can transpire. Obviously, what Nietzsche says about ancient Israel, Aquinas disagrees with vehemently, or he offers a very robust alternative position on ancient Israelite religion that's very beautiful. But, I mean, he could accommodate that kind of perspective, in fact, that the will to power could take over the designs of religious behavior in principle in various ways, and it could corrupt ways of being a Judeo-Christian observer of the law or practitioner of Christianity. You could use Christianity in a pathological way of the kind Nietzsche is talking about. It wouldn't be authentic Christianity, but that could exist, right? So Aquinas can accommodate a lot of the critical views of both Augustine and Bonaventure on the one side and Freud, Nietzsche, Marx on the other, because he can acknowledge that religious behavior is natural but is often subject to corruption or problematic exercise, a problematic form of exercise in the absence of the healing effects of grace. At the same time, where he's strong is, he wants to defend the rational warrant of religious behavior and show that when people in Christianity are religious, they are reclaiming something of the essence of the human person that's natural to the human being, to want to know the absolute mystery of God, to pray to God, the mystery we call God, to believe in divine providence, and to attempt to negotiate our life in this world through public and personal private acts of knowledge and love of God through prayer and devotion. And what that leaves us with, I think, is a kind of, let's just call it a position of ambivalence. I mean, that's a strange thing to finish on. But I think Aquinas leaves you with a kind of ambivalence about religion as it is often exerted in the concrete world around us, because it could be something more or less natural, but it could be something natural that's being a little bit infringed upon. It's imperfect. It could be that a non-Christian religious person is experiencing grace, and that religious impulses in them are being healed, and that they're healthy. You could meet a pious Hindu or Muslim who actually has deep and profoundly natural religious impulses. But Aquinas will say that is natural, and it's an effect of the healing work of grace working outside of Christianity, the visible Christian world. You could also have Christian prelates or human beings, lay Christian people, who are fragile or even corrupt in their exercise of the virtue of religion, and who are employing authentic Christian supernatural means, like the sacraments, for purely political or intra-worldly gain, because they haven't actually learned to love God and had their hearts and minds rehabilitated. You can have, now, I mean, I think with Aquinas' viewpoint, you do have to take a stand and say that the strong atheist positions are erroneous, but you have a basis to respond to them by saying that, yeah, I mean, name every pathology, bring it on, tell me, Marx, tell me about all the pathologies. But we actually already have a deeper way to account for those, because we want to acknowledge that actually human beings can only be religiously pathological because they are all first and foremost religious. And if you really want to fix the religious pathologies, be they political, psychological, or what have you, you aren't going to fix them through atheistic systems. And history tells us that, actually, I think. You're going to fix them through real religious behavior and what we call conversion. You know, so you need theological answers to these human problems of pathological religion. And so the atheist critique touches on some things that are real, but it doesn't provide us with the deep answers, either philosophically or theologically, because it's philosophically warranted to believe in the transcendent mystery of God, and it's theologically warranted to believe in the necessity of grace to rehabilitate the human person. The last thing I want to just finish by saying, and I will finish now, is that if Aquinas' account is right, one thing that's very important for contemporary theology is to recognize this. It will never be enough simply to seek to practice the theological virtues of faith, hope, and charity and celebrate the sacraments, even the sacrament of the Eucharist and the worship of Christ in the sacrifice of the Mass, if Christians don't also cooperate with grace, under grace, by cultivating natural virtues of religion. And Aquinas sees this as happening what he calls infused moral virtue, where the justice of religion is healed and elevated into the life of charity. But that requires that we actually practice the habits of prayer and devotion, of external worship, of adoration and sacrifice, and the other external acts of corporate worship that Aquinas details. You don't become a spiritual person without being a corporate, habitually practicing, disciplined religious person. And so the disciplines of the church and the learning of private and public religious devotion or love of God is a way that you kind of become a human religious person. Not enough to have a purely cerebral religion. You have to kind of train your mind and heart to acts of religion if you want to live in a kind of deeper communion with God and with other human beings. And I think that's a takeaway, because I think we now have there's been a recent slew of rather secular theories of cooperation with grace in the Catholic Church, wherein we can have a purely cognitive or purely immanentistic political moral framework. Like, if I seek justice in the immanent frame of human society, or the second table of the law, as Immanuel Kant says, that's the domain in which I'm really an ethical person. But actually, Aquinas thinks part of being an ethical person, even naturally, politically, and publicly, is loving God publicly. Loving God through worshiping Him privately and publicly, and not for some political end, but in order to be the kind of person who's oriented towards what's ultimate in the world, and that you need a civilization in which the primacy of ultimate love is tangible and instantiated through the real and true human religion, which is, you know, the religion made possible by Christ's grace, and the healing effects of that grace in the domain of natural religion, our natural religious dimension. Okay. I have finished talking about giving a talk. I see that Andre Constantin has asked everyone, and therefore also myself, a question. So I'm going to start with his question, and I'm going to invite you while I'm answering it to line up in the queue and write a few more questions. Objections, bemusements, controversial claim. I don't know what arguments. You know what I'm saying. I'm not made of glass. You can tell me what you think. Okay, so how much has Aristotle influenced Aquinas' Summa Theologica, specifically the reasons outlined for the existence of the Christian God? Well, as with all things in Thomistic interpretation, Andre, you have asked a super controversial question that Thomists spill a lot of ink and occasionally perhaps even blood over. I have written a book about this. That's really the wrong way to answer a question, and it sounds pretentious, and I suppose it just is pretentious, but it's a way of saying the inadequate answer I'm about to give you is the prelude to an even longer inadequate answer you could read in this book called Wisdom in the Face of Modernity. Because what I do there is I detail like how Gilson, famous 20th century commentator on Aquinas, tries to answer your question by claiming that Aquinas' core arguments are not that Aristotelian. They're much more based in his own original philosophy of existence and essence, which is a kind of interpretation of Avicenna, a critical interpretation of Avicenna, and a response to Avicenna. So in other words, Gilson sees Aquinas as his own man, philosophically, and I think there's a lot to that. I also think a lot of Aquinas doesn't just have five arguments he uses of God. That's the famous five ways, but if you look at the whole corpus, there's about 15 different arguments for the existence of God. A lot of them are standard questions, standard approaches that you find in the High Middle Ages. Now, my own view is, even when Aquinas takes on things from Avicenna or his other medieval contemporaries, he often at least lightly Aristotelianizes. So my view is that Aquinas is quite Aristotelian, but he also develops the Aristotelian system, if you want. I don't like that word, but the Aristotelian principles. I like that word better. He develops the Aristotelian principles organically in new and novel ways that Aristotle didn't, to accommodate the medieval arguments. And he Aristotelianizes the medieval arguments to give them a more scientific and demonstrative basis. So he's a very original Aristotelian. You might call him a medieval neo-Aristotelian. And that doesn't mean anything to anybody who's not interested in like intellectual history. But there are, there are basically real issues there about the logical integrity of the arguments. I'll just leave it at that. All right, let me go to. Do I say hello, Breno? Do I say Breno, or how do you say your name? You want to tell me audibly here for a second?
Breno, it's fine.
Okay.
Breno, it's fine.
All right. Yeah. Yes. We're moving from the email conversation to almost real life. What do you think about the proximity between Calvin and Thomas that Plantinga has advocated in the last few years? What's your opinion about the idea of the belief in God as a properly basic belief? Could we identify it with Aquinas' idea that the man is naturally religious? Okay, let me start. I'll try to answer this briefly and inadequately, but, you know, give some various points. First, I do not agree with Karl Barth at all, just on a textual basis in his reading of Calvin. I think Calvin has an extremely strong claim present in the Institutes about the natural knowledge of God, and that is also very prevalent in the Reformed tradition. So I just don't accept the argument that Barth makes as a historian of thought that Calvin does not have a so-called natural theology. It seems to me obvious he does. And I think Matthew Levering, in his recent book Proofs of God, in a short but helpful way, gets a Calvin right and shows that Calvin is even much stronger than Aquinas on, you might call it, an evidentialist or a priori intuitive knowledge of God that is properly basic. So I think Plantinga is interpreting Calvin plausibly to say that for Calvin, in a kind of Platonic way, reminiscent to me of Anselm, you just always already have some notion of God as the infinite sovereign first good in his transcendence given to you prior to or at the heart of, at the beginning of all other thought. It might be obscured to you by sin, but that comes mostly from the heart and the will. And the will is trapped in self-love, and it does hide from the knowledge of God. But at the same time, the knowledge of God is there, and it condemns you. I mean, I think that that's something that dynamics in Calvin. And that being the case, Calvin is closer to people like Anselm or John Damascene, who think the knowledge of God is much more escapable, unescapable. I think Aquinas does not hold such a strong view, because Aquinas does not believe in a prioristic, intuitive knowledge of God from an idea of God that it remains a kind of epistemological first principle. Bonaventure did hold that. Bonaventure says the first idea in the mind of every human being is that of infinite being and infinite goodness. And we understand every other being and every other good in light of this primal notion of the infinite good and the infinite being. So God is first epistemologically in the genetic order. And Aquinas rejects that view. I think he thinks the first thing you know are the beings around you in a vague and general way. And then you can eventually come to an imperfect but intuitive notion, an inferential idea, that there must be something behind everything else causing it. And you can come to the idea. In fact, I think Aquinas thinks it's not so difficult, even for a child, to come to the idea of God. He says, you know, it can exist in a pre-demonstrative, pre-philosophical, but natural way, working through experience. And ordinary people, and even children, can think pretty deeply about God, even naturally, if in a pre-philosophical, non-rigorous way, okay? So that he has a pretty strong notion of natural knowledge of God, but it's a lot weaker than Calvin, it seems to me. And so I don't think that there's a pure compatibility between Plantinga and Aquinas, although many things Plantinga holds are very close to Aquinas. I think Plantinga thinks arguments for the existence of God as Aquinas conducts them are plausible exercises of reason, but they come after, as it were, an already given certitude, and not just the certitude of nature, but also certitude of faith. So I think Aquinas has something a little bit more like modern foundationalism in him, where you can start from a kind of agnostic view of the world and start thinking about whether God exists, and you could be genuinely perplexed about that. And if somebody just tells you, I just know as a first principle that God exists, I think for Aquinas, you would suspect that that's ideological, or that that's coming from a theological a priori, but it might not be based in human nature. So I don't think they're totally compatible, but that's my view, you know, it's disputable. Okay, Peter asks, I have a question I like to pose verbally. Okay, go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay. First of all, that was a wonderful talk. I really appreciate that. As a little background, I've been engaged in a correspondence with a Catholic theologian whose name I will not mention, but he's got an article that will appear in Novae Vetra next year. And the question we've been, one of the questions we've been debating is whether or not religion is natural in the present historical order. Now, he holds that prior to the fall, yes, it was natural, but that after the fall, human beings now do not love God naturally, which is the position that I hold. Even after the fall, human beings love God naturally. He holds that because of the fall, the love of God above all else is no longer natural, and that consequently, religion cannot be viewed as natural in the present historical order.
Mm-hmm.
And for it to become natural, we would need certain supernatural instrumentalities to bring about that reordering so that we begin to love God above all else, even above ourselves. He maintains that now, in this current order, we love ourselves above all else.
Yeah.
That's not good, he thinks, but he says now that's natural.
Yeah.
I know how I would respond to that, but I want to hear how you might respond to that.
Okay. So that's perfectly clear. I, as you explain the view of this theologian, who I must say I don't know, although I'm the editor of the magazine, so probably should know.
It's an obligation.
Yeah. So, the key text on this is in the Summa Theologia, Prima Secunda, first part of the second part, question 109, article 3. And also Article 4 matters. In that article, Aquinas, he's looking at the effects of the necessity of grace and the effects of sin, and he asks whether in our fallen state we can love God naturally above all things. And he says no. Now, he doesn't say exactly, he doesn't actually say what your friend says as you report him, okay? He says it is natural to us to love God above all things, even in our fallen state now. But because of the weaknesses of the will and the effects of original sin, we tend, effectively, to always prefer the primacy of the love of the private good, which he calls the primacy of the love of self, over the love of God, who he calls the common good of the whole universe. In other words, instead of loving God naturally above all things, as we ought to, you might say philosophically speaking, as the common good of all things, we love ourselves, who are our private good, a real good, but we privilege the love of self as an effect of original sin. And he says we can't get out of this because of our fallen state. Now, that doesn't mean we don't have a natural love of God. He thinks we do. And it's not eradicated, but it's frustrated. He says quite clearly, the inclination to love God naturally above all things remains in us. The natural inclination remains in us. And it's intelligible philosophically, but in the realizations, we can't conduct ourselves to realize it effectively and well without the healing effects of grace. So it's not like there's no natural structure. It's also not like there are no natural inclinations, but the realizations are hindered. And he goes on to say in Article 4, significantly, can we keep the whole of the Ten Commandments without grace in this life, the first three of which have to do with the primacy of the natural love of God, as he interprets them? And he says, no, we can't. Now, he's basing himself there on the Catholic condemnations of Pelagius in the Council of Carthage and thereafter in 411 and then in the Second Council of Orange. So if you do say you can carry out all the Ten Commandments by your own natural powers, including the love of God above all things, without fail, the risk is that you actually maintain the Pelagian position, which is nature has not been damaged by sin. Nature is damaged by sin. Then you get the arguments about how deeply it has been damaged. And Aquinas has our nature being moderately damaged, meaning we can do some good moral activity. He doesn't believe things like Gregory of Rimini, who influenced Luther, which is to say all of our acts are naturally radically depraved. There's the worm of self-love eating at the core of the apple in every human act. Aquinas doesn't go that far at all.
Right.
He thinks we can do a lot of... But when it comes to the natural love of God, the structure is in us. But it's like, you know, it's like the washing machine where a key part's missing and you can't really clean the clothes. Sorry for the vulgar American metaphor that makes us into a machine. That's terrible. But, you know, the point is to say something very concrete. The structure's still there, okay? But we need grace to come in and fix the natural structure so it can work again.
Right. All right. Thank you so much.
Okay. All right, so I see next Bernardo. Thanks for the great lecture. Okay, well, that's a disputable view. In your view, what are the most glaring ways in which a corrupted religious urge is expressed in our Western modern culture? Well, I don't want to sound too... you know, of course, the temptation is the Catholic priest becomes highly moralizing and then confirms every stereotype. We love our all human beings. All human beings are interesting, including the most secular. They're interesting particularly because they're not religious. Interesting philosophically, as it were. But I alluded to what I think is the most prevalent displacement of religion, which is that which comes about through Kant, which is to take the next greatest common good. I mean, if you lose God, then you've got the cosmos. It's a kind of project, maybe a kind of environmental cosmic mysticism. But really where we can get stuff happening is in politics. And so the absolutization of the horizon of politics through the belief in a kind of forever progressing human history of political liberation and progress. I mean, I think that's where the religious energies go. I'm not denying that there's such a thing as political progress. I think there's also grave political regress. And different eras have enlightenment with regards to some things and darkening in the mind with regards to other things. There's a lot of things we're not allowed to talk about right now that are happening that are very bad, like taking unborn human life in the womb, which you can't talk about, but it's bad. And at the same time, it's true, we have less slavery, but you know what? We do have a lot of slavery. We have a lot of slavery in the world today. And so some of our narratives of progress obscure, keep us from seeing things that are happening. But, you know, there can be real progress, and there can be progress through technology and education and so forth, and there can be groups discriminated against, and there's a redressing of the balance and so forth. But I don't think that political activity can bear the almost religious weight that human beings, I don't know, we sort of adorn... our political activity with a religious weight that I think we ought not to, and that can happen even in very sanctimoniously religious ways. And, you know, then things have to disappear, inconvenient things have to disappear from view, like death, you know, deep metaphysical problems like mortality. Well, we can't do anything about that. You know, you die and then you're no longer part of the story, right? The real story goes on, it's the political story. And once you're either old and you know, not present in the political story, or you get excommunicated because of something you wrote on Twitter 20 years ago, or you die, you're no longer part of the religious story of man, which is the story of religious progress. I think that there's some immanentism there. That's okay, James Gallagher, you have a question you'd like to say audibly.
Hi, thanks. Thank you for the talk. It was great. If Nietzsche believes that the Hellenistic religiosity is better than the Judeo-Christian religiosity, does he talk about why it held? Is it because the masses tend to be repressed, like the people in the Babylonian exile? And so if that is the case, kind of what hope does he have for that it would change? And you know, that would just be my wondering of what your thought on that was.
Well, I don't want to make a hash of speaking about Nietzsche, who is a person who it would be good to have a Nietzsche expert try to answer this question. So I'm just saying, like, I have imperfect knowledge, although I've read a lot of Nietzsche and I'm interested in him. I think he thinks that the 19th century bourgeois German world in which he's writing is a world of decadent post-medieval Christianity in which, as he says, we, meaning modern bourgeois post-Lutheran secular society, have killed God, but we have not yet realized it. God is dead. We have killed him. What he means by that is, I think, that there was an attempt to place all the riches of European intellectual society and ethical and political life at the service of the Hebraic Judeo-Christian revelation, and that met a high water mark in the Middle Ages. Nietzsche's not a fan. The Enlightenment was the dawn of a liberation, but that liberation has not taken on all of its effects yet. And he sees himself in a certain way as a radical inaugural thinker. He's an inaugural thinker radicalizing the trends of the Enlightenment. And what he wants to do is clear out the last vestiges, the limelight, the soft limelight, last light of Christian thinking and ethics, and make room for a new post-Christian world, which I think is, on the one hand, a world very much based on positivism. There's an empiricist element in Nietzsche. It's not so much the sciences, but it's the idea that we have no deep metaphysical constructive ideas about reality. We just experience appearances, sensate forms. And then on the other side is an idealist side that I think influences Heidegger afterwards and Foucault, which is all of our deep explanations of life, our search for meaning, our constructions of reason, are basically play. And so instead of seeing them in this grave moral content like the Christian medievals wanted to, what we need to see them as is the free play of poetry. And so what we're left with is a kind of world of sensate appearances in which we are born and die, and then we have the artful play of making sense of things as we should wish artistically. I like Heidegger's interpretation, which is disputable, that Nietzsche's grounding idea in a way is the will to art, the freedom of the artist to create a noble vision of the world against the backdrop of a physical cosmos that's not necessarily meaningful. But the meaning is the meaning we give it. The meaning is the meaning of the artistic play of the human race that tells poetic ideas in the time before we die and lives without regret. That's, I think, what the cycle of return is about. We live without regret in the face of death, in the freedom of that space we're given, or that happens between birth and death, without the regrets of thinking we need to justify our world morally or cosmically or religiously. So I think something like that's going on. And he sees himself at a period where Germany is not yet woken up to its, you know, this new, if you read it, Ecce Homo, he did write, he was losing his mind when he wrote it, but I think it's arguably coherent with the earlier work, where he talks about his prophetic role to bring on a new age of post-nihilist thinking. But you have to go through the nihilism, you have to accept there's a kind of meaninglessness to life, and then you come out the other side finding the new meaning. So it's very bleak and very stark and in a way very beautiful, and it poses a major radical challenge to Western European thought in general, and Christianity in particular. And I think it's wrong, but it's so radical that to feel its reverberations and challenge is meritorious. Elizabeth, how are you? I'm going to look at your question now. I'm thinking of the natural religious nature of children. There were debates during the 30s and 40s of the 19th century in America concerning capabilities of children of genuine faith and experience true conversion. Does this speak to different views concerning the naturalness of religiosity in humans? I find it interesting that the infantilization that atheistic philosophers charge as religious persons assumes a negative view of infancy and childhood. Yes, it does. An adult-centric perspective. Yeah, I like that. It's interesting that this contrasts with Jesus' valorization of childhood models. Yes, okay. So I think you got to be nuanced here. Aquinas, in other words, is a both and. Like, we don't want to absolutize the immature state of reason and freedom in children as the archetypal state of human development. We do reach a maturity of reasoning and freedom in our adult period, and that can then even develop throughout life. At the same time, as we know, Christianity gave great, great value to children in a way that ancient Roman didn't, and there's stark examples of that with infanticide and etc. I mean, I think Aquinas thinks that children who reach the age of reason can come fairly readily, if not almost immediately at some point, whenever they reach the age of reason. It's almost defined by Aquinas, the age of reason, not just by like being able to do syllogisms, but able to think about God in a reasonable way. And it is true if you work pastorally with children, just as a matter of fact, pre-rational children at 4 and 5 can pray to God and think things intuitively about God. They have to be led by their parents, but they get there. They make the acts, it seems to me. And certainly kids that are 6 and 7 who've reached the age of reason can think about things like life under God in this world, divine providence, the meaning of evil, life after death, and they can ask extremely profound questions. And that is rational behavior. The fact that they can't write it out in symbolic logic and publish it at OUP is not proof that it isn't rational behavior. And if you don't have a vision of reason sufficiently large to accommodate that, you don't have a good vision of reason. Because reason has a lot of different expressions, and some of it is rational. And, you know, look, you could take the whatever purest philosopher in the world are, David Hume's the world, God knows what, arguing assiduously. If they have kids and the kid is in the kitchen and the kid is asking them a question at age 6, or there's a disciplinary matter in which reason has to be used, you will see them reasoning with their children. That is what happens. You treat children as agents of reason, and you punish them when they aren't reasonable because you want them to learn the discipline of being reasonable. All of parental education that's disciplinary is about making the child reasonable and responsible. So that presupposes there's a principal reason already operative. And as we can see, they can pray. Now, most of the time, in terms of grace, now, so they are naturally religious, if in a less sophisticated way. Okay, sorry to talk about grace. Where are they more human than us? Well, they're more human often in the domain of love. Why? More human. Well, how could they be more human? They accept vulnerability and dependency more unquestioningly. As we become more autonomous, in some way we become more mature, more responsible, more intellectual. Great. Good for us. Pat on the back. But we can also become less capable of spontaneously and freely, you might say sweetly, engaging in dependence, love, trust, devotion to others, compassion. Right? We see people on the street who are homeless. We walk right by. The child, when they see someone in the family who's hurting, is more likely to engage emotionally because they want to heal them, even naively. Right? So there's that vulnerability. You see that also in mentally disabled people. They often go further in love than non-mentally disabled people, even though they don't go as far as intelligence. You have Down syndrome children who have extraordinary capacity to love and trust other people. And Christianity, which places an emphasis on human dignity through love and not just through knowledge or excellence or nobility, sees in that something eminently human philosophically as well as theologically, that we're made in the image of God, but also that shows human dignity philosophically, reasonably. All right, so you have that. Now, in the order of grace, most people don't become saints as children, but the historical reality of child saints is not as rare as we might think. Padre Pio, whose feast day was yesterday, had clearly evidenced high degrees of sanctity as a 6- and 7-year-old child. It was also true of Catherine of Siena. There have been saints who died in childhood in holy ways, and by that I mean before they reached adolescence. So you do have children saints, which shows you that God's grace, because God can't do things in the order of grace without a natural platform. Grace doesn't act against nature. So that shows you if God can create saints in childhood, people who love God mystically and are like extraordinarily holy, praying 6 hours a day and whatnot. The children at Fatima, 2 of whom died, right, doing penance in their childhood. If God's grace can work, that means there's a natural platform. He can't act by grace against our nature. That means there's already a natural disposition to religious behavior there. Okay, so. I feel like I should take one more question and liberate you all, because, I mean, it's been a long time now. Okay, so I'm going to finish with Teresita. So now in the pandemic era, the world is living in a violent time where I think we can need more persons who believe in God. Okay, that's not a question. That's a comment. I agree with that. We always need... I do think, I'll say this, socially speaking, so we have a lot in the United States currently. I'm in Rome, but in the United States there's a lot of social conflict, tremendous social conflict. And in the world more generally, there's the confrontation with all the natural... the effects of a natural disorder of human illness. And so you have you have overlapping social crises we're confronting. I don't think human beings can achieve, practically speaking, ultimate practical perspective on how to live life, both through human-generated social conflict and, you might say, cosmically generated natural evil or natural disadvantages. I don't think we can navigate our way through these things practically, ultimately, in an ultimate way, without a religious horizon of reflection. And it's not enough to have a religious horizon of reflection. We have to have a habitually religious way of life, to love God in the midst of everything. And I do think it's salutary for us, but also for other people, when there are religious people who point us towards the absolute in the midst of our ongoing blessings and travails in life, right? So it's a very general thing, but it seems like a safe and important, reasonable conclusion from the principles Aquinas states.